Hello, everyone, and welcome to this very special episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Therapeutics, Technology, and Real-World Perspectives. My name is Diana Isaacs, and I am a clinical pharmacist and a diabetes care and education specialist at the Cleveland Clinic.
And my name is Natalie Bellini. I am a nurse practitioner at R&B Medical Group.
And why we are so excited and why this episode is so special is because we are at the American Diabetes Association Scientific Sessions in New Orleans. And so we are going to have very special guests with us today. And with that, we are going to dive right into our content.
We are so excited to be here today with Dr. Sean and Dr. Tamara Oser. So if you both wouldn't mind just introducing yourselves and telling us a little bit about your practice.
Sure, we're thrilled to be here. Thanks for having us. So I'm Dr. Tamara Oser, and I work at University of Colorado and currently see patients in the eastern plains of rural Colorado in a federally qualified health center where I care for a large immigrant and refugee population with many different languages, and the least of which is English.
And I'm Dr. Sean Oser, a family physician and champion and researcher for diabetes technologies, especially in primary care. My practice is a university-owned system, university system-owned practice in the South Denver region, where we have a lot of English-speaking patients, but also some other determinants and a pretty broad variety of patients that we serve.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
So can you tell us a little bit about research that you're currently doing?
So our focus in the Primary Care Diabetes Lab is on implementing diabetes technologies into primary care and focusing on trying to decrease disparities and make sure that everybody with diabetes has access to evidence-based diabetes technologies.
So yeah, that's one of the things that has driven both of us is to try to make sure that where we see disparities in care, we see them a lot in diabetes because there are efforts to bring the newest best technologies and treatments to patients, and we've seen so much progress in the last several years, but they tend to be focused more where the people are in the greatest populations, right? So in the cities and the coasts where there is endocrinology specialty care, we have great support from the companies doing research and bringing new products to market, but they tend to get focused on the subspecialty practices. And we know that fully 50% of adults with type 1 diabetes get their diabetes care from primary care, and 90% of type 2 diabetes care is delivered in primary care. So it's harder to support that throughout the primary care geography because we are so spread out. It's harder for the companies to focus those resources. But if we don't do that, then it widens the disparities between who has access to some of the latest, greatest things and are having better outcomes and getting better treatments and using technology and who is not.
We also know from some of our research, we did a national survey where we surveyed family physicians, primary care, also nurse practitioners who practice in primary care. And we know that even if there is endocrinology nearby, there are still many barriers to all patients being able to see endocrinology. So whether that's patients not following through, long wait times, insurance coverage. So really, really imperative that we focus as teams to try to provide the best diabetes care.
So one of our greatest focuses right now is on continuous glucose monitoring and bringing that technology to primary care. So we see tremendous uptake in endocrinology, and uptake hasn't been so great in primary care. One of the studies that we've done, in that survey, we found that over 99% of those surveyed, and the sample size was over 800 respondents between family medicine and nurse practitioners. But 99% of them, more than 99%, had heard of continuous glucose monitoring, and it was somewhere in the range of about 37% that had ever prescribed CGM. So there's a big gap between, they know it exists, but they just haven't taken the bite to do that. And actually that 37% was a little higher than we even expected. So we're really looking at ways to try to enable that step to be taken because they're ready, they're interested. We have a newer project following on from that to actually implement CGM into, our goal was 60 primary care practices across the state of Colorado. And we were very worried about being able to reach that number. We weren't quite sure how we were gonna do that. And we were ready to beat the bushes and do all kinds of things for recruitment of these practices. And this is practices, not providers, so 60 practices. And when we opened recruitment in 2.5 days, I think, we had 79 practices.
Wow.
And we were getting, you know, reach out from our research team saying, what do we do? We need a wait list, shut it off. So I think that really speaks to the excitement of primary care for wanting to adopt new technologies. We're studying three different implementation models because obviously excitement is one part, but if we don't figure out how to work within the primary care workflow, make sure that we know how to help them with interpreting the data, support the patient so that we don't just have people put on and then device discontinuation, want to solve the problem. So we're looking at three different implementation strategies to better understand how do you implement CGM into primary care with the diversity of practices, right? Some practices are lucky enough that they have a CDCES or a clinical pharmacist or other team members. Others are out in solo practice, they might have MAs. So really looking at who on the team can fill the different roles from prior auth, patient identification, how do we help primary care learn how to use the data with CGM?
And we're not presuming to know that, I'll start that part over.
Yeah.
So we know that primary care practices can look and be built and work in many different ways. So we've really scaled our efforts to be able to have this accessible to the small solo practice with one provider, to the large group practice that has 15 or 20 providers, and not to presume that we know what kind of staffing is available in these practices, but to help understand that these are the tasks that need to happen in order to get CGM into your patients in primary care, and when it's appropriate, and when it would be a better idea, when it might not be as useful, the change package that we built with the help of the American Academy of Family Physicians is one of the implementation strategies we're looking at, either with or without additional professional practice facilitation to shepherd that project through the practice. And then the third implementation strategy is a virtual CGM initiation service where it's really not meant to be just refer the patient and I don't have to worry about it anymore. But these are all practices that expressed interest in implementing CGM into their practice. So our goal is to educate the practice, not just the providers, but the practice at all the levels that need to be able to support this, so that when we're finished with a relatively brief engagement with them over about 6 months, that they'll be able to initiate CGM after that and maintain that for their patients going forward.
And excited as part of that we're going to be looking at how do you then make this scalable? Because obviously,
right.
It's a dream come true to live in Colorado and have all of these primary care practices that may be able to now prescribe CGM. But what we really need to do is make sure this happen on a national level. So we're putting together a practice facilitation change package so that other health systems will know how to implement this and make it scalable. Almost every health system has somebody who could act as a practice facilitator, or they have technology champions like CDCES, clinical pharmacists. In addition to that, we're putting together for the virtual CGM initiation service, we're putting together a toolkit. So we've staffed this with people working in the primary care space. We have clinical pharmacists working in the primary care space, and we also have CDCES, who's primary care. So how can you look at the resources that your healthcare system has and then implement this in your healthcare system to increase access to CGM in primary care?
That is phenomenal. That is really phenomenal. Wow.
Yeah, that's amazing, because it's like, that's the biggest struggle
right now.
That's
the biggest, that is, in every talk we've been to throughout ADA so far this year, and I can't imagine it's going to change for the next day and a half. That is the ultimate, is you come to an endocrinology practice, and we have a system in place, and it is what happens, but you go to a primary care office, and they want to do it, but they can't, and they don't know how, I love the idea that you have different models for different practices, so you're not asking them to do a lot of change in their modeling itself of how they operate. You're asking to get in and work within their model.
Yeah, I think that's so crucial, and I think a lot of people don't realize the diversity of primary care practices. We get asked all the time, tell us about workflow in primary care, and we're like, well, which office?
Right.
I think Sean and I have practiced in a variety of primary care settings. Right now, our practices couldn't be more different.
Right.
I'm at an FQ, very vulnerable population. He's in a suburban multi-specialty practice. So how do you make this work for a variety of different practices? And we're, so beyond lucky that the Helmsley Charitable Trust found this very important. So they're funding our work to really understand how do you move CGM into primary care.
So can you tell us a little bit more about that? About that, the funding, and how long is this going to, what is going to happen next? So what's your next step in this? You've got these practices, they're ready to go, you've built the models. Tell us what it looks like over the next 6 months to 2 or 3 years.
Yes.
As this study happens.
Absolutely. So it's already in progress. So the practices are recruited. We started our first wave of practices in April, and the practice facilitation is already, that's moving forward. They've already had a couple of sessions. That's going really well. Have gotten some surprising, unexpected questions from practices about also starting insulin pumps. which we certainly didn't expect to hear from primary care. This is really focused on CGM. So again, I do think it speaks to the excitement of primary care and related to diabetes technologies. The virtual CGM initiation service is opening up its door to patients this coming week. And then the practices that are using the module that we developed, the practice transformation package with the American Academy of Family Physicians, are already underway. We're evaluating this on several levels. So we're looking at practice level implementation outcomes. So with the different implementation models, how much progress do they make? You know, is one model clearly better than the other? Of course, though, looking within the framework of what are the types of practices. So what we hope to learn is in certain phenotypes of primary care practices, what implementation models work best. We're also looking at patient level outcomes, both clinical and psychosocial. And then we're doing a health economics outcomes as well, because we obviously need to understand, well, how much does each arm cost in order to move forward and really figure out how to do this in primary care.
So I'm going to switch gears just a little bit, because I understand that you also are involved with the Beta Bionics dual hormone insulin pump study. So I would love to hear about your role in that and how we're going to bring that to primary care.
Sure.
Yeah. We're just going to get to talk about that because that is so exciting. So yeah, I'm going to jump in.
Sure.
So we're the first primary care team that is implementing the insulin only Isla into primary care, which is so exciting, such an honor and such a privilege to do that. So that study is underway. We already have finished with two participants. I think that one of the things that is so neat is they are participants that had never considered an insulin pump. By nature of the study, they have to be on MDI, recruited through primary care practices. So really that population that would not normally have access to even being a part of these studies. Both participants hugged us when the study was done, thanked us for the opportunity to be in a study like this, and they had never considered using any kind of pump therapy, and now both are very excited to look at how they can transition from MDI into pump therapy. So that
has been amazing. I would go one step further, and they actually had considered pump therapy multiple times, but they had actively declined every time that it came up. So they had never positively considered it. And
better way to frame it.
Remember this one. He finished, and he truly, I stopped pushing a pump at me, and this was not to his primary care provider, but this was to endocrinologists that he'd seen over the years also. Whoever it was that he was seeing would bring up the idea of a pump, and he'd say, no, stop talking about a pump. And then at the end of his involvement using the insulin-only bionic pancreas, he sort of slowly started to hand it back to us, and he said, bye, little buddy.
What a wonderful thing.
No, wonderful. And I think to speak to your point, he had seen endocrine a few times over the years. And I think that is also possibly why he was in primary care. He was hoping not to be bothered about diabetes technology.
Right.
So he was in for a surprise when we come in and say, hey, do you want to be a part of this study?
I also think it's interesting when you said half of people with type 1 don't have access or don't see an endocrinologist for lots of different reasons.
Right.
To say we can put patients on sensors, and they can see the data, the patients can see it, as well as the clinician. So now they're saying, we have to do something.
Yeah.
Now we can see that there's more of a problem, and we get back to that, what is A1C? A1C
right.
is an average. So now you're seeing all these postprandial highs and timing of insulin, and we have these AID systems that
right.
truly help patients sleep better at night and be safe.
Correct.
So I love that. I think...
Oh, I was going to say, that's one of the reasons I'm so excited to be involved in this study of the islet and bringing this truly into primary care is that the AID systems, including that one, which of course isn't FDA approved yet, not available, but it is able to, it automates so much that and it requires so little for setup that we can really, we may not have a lot of time in primary care, and it's very common to hear in primary care, just don't give me one more thing. But if we give you something that will make it easier than what you're doing now, then there will be huge appetite for that. And we've seen that with CGM. We expect to see that with AID systems like the islet, and the ability to get it started up so easily compared to having to figure out and program all the basal rates and the carb ratios and the correction factors is what has this ready for primary care. We're seeing some of that with Omnipod 5 also, which has some learning of basal rates, right? So there's, as we step more and more towards more automation and more learning, this becomes much more ripe for primary care. And I think that this study will show us, and in our experience with two participants so far, that this is ready for primary care.
So tell me what the iLet specifically does, because I don't know that all of our viewers can understand the differences. So tell me about starting an iLet versus another AID system.
Sure. Do you want to describe that?
I will start, and then you can jump in. So I think, you know, our daughter has type 1, and Sean has type 1 as well. So we're really familiar with the process they went through when they got started on pump therapy. And there's, in my mind, it would be a really special and rare primary care team that could handle that amount of workload. The thing that's really different about the iLet is that the only thing that you need to initiate the system is the patient's weight. So there's no calculating basal rates or insulin carb ratios, anything like that. It literally is just inputting the patient's weight, and then it starts to learn from there on. The other thing that is really neat about it is that there's no actual specific carb counting. So what the patients do is they put in whether they're having a meal that is usual for them or more than usual, things like that, versus having to say, okay, look at this, and this is 63 grams of carbs. So obviously still really important for anybody with diabetes to have a general understanding, and that's why it's so important to also think of models where we can partner with CDCES, clinical pharmacists, to help with some of that education.
Right.
But they also can then kind of just stall it, so it's not requiring necessarily the same level of education that might be needed otherwise in terms of that carb counting piece. So it's a really exciting opportunity. It's been really fun to see how this is working with these participants.
And contrast that with our experience of my starting an insulin pump and of our daughter starting an insulin pump. We each had to go to carb counting class so that we could be cleared to even be put in the pipeline for considering an insulin pump and demonstrate our proficiency with carb counting. And with the iLet, there really is none. You're just trying to get in the ballpark of, as you said, is this the usual amount of carbs for this meal for me? Is this breakfast, lunch, or dinner? And is this usual? Is it more or is it less? And that is carb counting. After I demonstrated my ability to carb count and was allowed to pursue an insulin pump, I then had a daily phone call after my pump training. I had which was a few hours long and with good reason, but I had to learn about infusion sets and everything like that, and we'll need that with any of these systems, including the iLet. But I then had a daily phone call from the prescriber for 2 weeks to figure out the basal rates and the correction factors and the carb ratios every day for 2 weeks. And it was a tremendous amount of time, a tremendous amount of effort. And truly, as you said, you just, for the iLet, you put in the patient's weight and you press go, and then it figures all of that out. And it figures it out forever. So even once mine were figured out manually, they tend not to get revisited very often, even though things change, right? My weight goes up a little, my weight goes down a little, I'm more active, I'm less active, but it's always adjusting, it's always learning, and this is truly distinguishing it from any other thing out there that will constantly adapt and improve along with the patient's experience, and it does so much of that initial learning. They've shown in so many of their studies that learning is already well on its way after 24 hours or 48 hours. They're getting unbelievable glycemic results with much, much, much less effort from the patient, who is only putting in the size of their meal and then changing the setting when they need to.
That is phenomenal.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think the really important thing is patient choices, right? So obviously there's not going to be any one technology that's for every patient. And so the more choices that we can have, the more that we can partner with endocrinology, with CDCS, clinical pharmacists, really do team-based care and think about novel ways to increase access to technology to just diverse patient populations, I think, is really the key thing.
You are speaking my language. And yeah, we was fortunate to attend a session with the Beta Bionics report out here at ADA, and the results look so impressive. Those were done in endocrinology clinics, but it's really exciting to see now we'll get results in implementation in primary care. So to kind of close us out today, the last question we want to ask you is just what you are most excited about at ADA SCI sessions, either something you've already attended or something that you're looking forward to attending.
So I'll start by actually saying that the best thing about being here is being in person. So kudos to ADA for not only allowing that virtual option, but they've done such a spectacular job with an in-person conference. My first in-person conference since COVID. So this has been a really special opportunity to be able to come together with collaborators, do that in-person brainstorming that you just can't find anywhere else virtual. And then I think the focus on the health disparities has been just so impactful, including intersectionality and a lot of other topics that are really hard to address and so important to address.
I agree. There's so much going on. There's so much change and there's so much progress in diabetes right now. And the ability to attend sessions is wonderful. It is it feels richer to attend sessions in person than it does to watch them by video. But then we walk to the exhibit hall, or we walk to the poster hall, or we walk to the next session, and we bump into each other in person, and that spawns so many more conversations, which also spawns so many more ideas, and the ability to incrementally grow the ideas of what comes next has been amazing, and it's something that I haven't felt while we've been all virtual.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for sharing your expertise, and wishing you the best rest of the meeting.
Thanks.
Thanks so much for having us.